Good morning, everybody. I hope you're enjoying your practice today, and you're finding a way to settle in so you can experience yourself more as a kind of a continuity that flows from one breath to another, and one activity to another, whether it's zazen to kinhin, or zazen to kinhin to zazen to chanting, or whatever the activity is. And that you can do this without getting sidetracked too much in the mind. The sensor, this ability really to flow from one activity to another is a very wonderful, and also it's a very traditional way for us to practice in Zen practice. Finding a way to practice being intimate with whatever we encounter moment by moment by moment is really a hallmark of Zen practice, as I think many of you know. It's like a gentle breeze that just kind of flows continuously and somewhat effortlessly. I mean, there's some effort to maintain that quality of mind, but it's like a breeze that flows, you know, with continuity and somewhat effortlessly through a forest, gently sort of touching and passing many ferns and trees and animals and insects and all the life of the forest as it goes through, not distracted or obstructed by anything that it encounters. But just sort of meeting it and moving on, that kind of breeze. So maybe just lightheartedly, excuse me, if we think of ourselves as that kind of breeze. I don't know if you've ever thought of yourself as a breeze before, but it's possible. So if we think of ourselves as that kind of breeze, we can get the feeling or the idea and begin to practice that way. Kind of breezy Zen. And of course, focusing on the breath, which is so important no matter what we encounter, keeps us present and grounded and helps this to come about. Zen doesn't have to be some kind of really heavy, intense practice. It can be breezy. It can be very light-hearted. We just sort of lightly touch and keep going. So many times we are able to practice in a quiet and concentrated way that supports and makes this mostly effortless continuity possible. That's true. But also, when we lose our concentration and we allow the mind somewhat flighty or maybe, let's say, too windy aspect to get strong by following it and getting caught by its narrative storyline as it jumps from one thought or one feeling to another, we lose the flow and we end up spending our time always trying to get started again. It's sort of like a motor that just won't kick in. So this approach, this always trying to get started again, which is really a product of our dualistic, habitual thinking mind that ends up strengthening that part of the ego that's a little worried about losing its control, which makes it more difficult for us to really stay with ourselves and really touch the self. This can become a pretty exhausting way to practice, and it doesn't really allow us to settle the self on the self. It's a very important phrase, to settle the self on the self, as we say in Zen, so that we can really touch the reality of what we are. And this is why it's so important to establish and maintain a calm and steady approach to practice, very steady, especially during retreat, without too much drama or too many ups and downs, so we can experience life with a depth and a quality of being that is really so miraculous, so life-affirming and so wondrous, that all of the teachings of the Buddha and of Dogen and of all of our female and male ancestors through the stories and the literature of Zen become immediately apparent. They become apparent to us through our own experience. And we find ourselves sometimes saying, yes, this is what they were talking about. It's so obvious. It's so clear. I wonder why I didn't see it before. though I think we do know why we didn't see it before. We've all experienced how that windy mind of ours scatters our attention like 1,000 leaves falling and twisting and turning in 1,000,000 directions, which causes us to lose touch before we even know that actually we're gone. I think we're, you know, we've all been our very own autumn leaf shower. And all you have to do is look at the trees, letting go of their leaves, spinning in every direction to know what our minds look like sometimes. The other day, the other day, as part of helping my lungs to open up fully so I can really maximize my ability to breathe properly again, as part of my program, I walked from the house up to the road to take my daily walk. And then, because I was already a little out of breath, even though it's not a very a far distance, but a little walking up a little bit of an incline is a little challenge at this point. But because I was a little out of breath, even before beginning my somewhat, it's not very long, but somewhat longer walk down the road, which I tried to do every day, I sat down. I really had to pay attention to my body since the surgery to help with my recovery. I've had to study the body in the body and study the mind in the mind, as I was talking about yesterday, so that I can really take the best care of what's right in front of me, which right now is letting my body come fully back to itself, my recovery. It's a little like being my own navigational system in body and mind, so I don't end up doing things that are counterproductive. And also studying the feelings and the feelings, so I don't let any kind of impatience or discouragement, I don't feel much of it, but you know, it moves through. You know, get in my way, basically, of just going forward. And as I'm sure you know, when we're in touch and when we listen to our bodies, which is part of what the Buddha meant when he said we should study the body in the body's actual experience of itself, our bodies have a really incredible way of letting us know what's going on. So it's good if we just listen. We just stay in touch and we don't override what we're being told in our bodies with fancy but useless, mixed-up thinking, to quote the Chinese poet Han Shan, which many of you know I've been translating Han Shan's extant work with Kaz Ta-Nehisi, and that book will be out in next June, in fact. It's the most complete version of Han Shan's poetry in English. Han Shan is Cold Mountain. Anyway, so he has this phrase, useless mixed-up thinking, and it's, you know, can be pretty entertaining, but it's, we don't want to let it override our actual experience in our bodies. I really love that phrase, by the way, useless mixed-up thinking, because it's so spot on for what we do sometimes, don't you think? But great as that phrase is, maybe today, because it's our autumn study retreat, to honor that, I'll just call it windy thinking, or too windy thinking. Anyway, in order to catch my breath, after walking up to near the road, I sat on a little stone wall, and I noticed that a sort of spiny, spindly weed, about 18 inches tall, was just kind of gently brushing up against my arm. And as I looked at it, this thought came to me. Once you know how precious your life is, you know how precious every life is, and you wouldn't want to harm it. So that's what I was thinking. Once you know how precious your life is, you know how precious every life is, and you wouldn't want to harm it. And that's what I was thinking as I looked at the weed. But because I consider my walk a part of my continuous practice, I was in practice mode, I was in practice mind. So I studied the mind in the mind, and I noticed, even though I had that thought, I noticed the slightest passing impulse in the mind to pull the weed out of the ground for no good reason at all. Have you ever felt that kind of impulse? You're just sitting there, and there's some lovely little thing growing next to you, and all of a sudden you have the impulse to just yank it out of the ground. But my practice mind showed me that impulse or thought before I could act on it. And that thought was born of my dualistic habitual mind that says, oh, I'm this and that's that. And I can do what I want with it. That's how we think. sometimes. And so my practice mind replaced that impulse with the thought that was more connected and in concert with the flow of life. And right after that, as if it was generated by the first thought, a second thought came, which was stronger and more true to how I live and want to live. And that thought was, once you hurt or you're in pain, you wouldn't want to hurt anything else or cause that thing pain. So the mind of continuous practice helped the Buddha way of oneness, of connection and intimacy, of compassion and ahimsa. Ahimsa is a Sanskrit term that means the absence of violence from one's mind. It's a really great term, ahimsa, the absence of violence from one's mind. It helped it to be just right there as my mind noticed itself, and it brought me back to a reality very much in keeping with our deepest vows. Not to hurt all beings, but to help, to save, to liberate, to free from suffering all beings. And it's important to remember that when we do notice the expression of our dualistic or habitual and disconnected thinking, we don't judge ourselves for having such thoughts or even such impulse. We just notice them and bear witness to them. We know they exist, and then we let them go. It's like saying, there's that kind of impulse again. Still taking its turn on the old tape of the mind. It's an impulse, but we do nothing else about it. We don't take the next step and then start to think less of ourselves or get down on ourselves for the fact that these kinds of impulses exist. We might even use the opportunity of noticing it to be grateful that our practice mind helps us to see such things in ourselves very clearly so we can help ourselves. This not getting down on ourselves or calling ourselves names or feeling doubt about, you know, the sincerity of our practice or our vows, this is ahimsa. This is the practice of absence of violence in the mind toward ourselves. This lack of a punishing attitude, which most of us have learned, a kind of punishing attitude toward the self, I think you'd admit it. This not allowing that punishing, self-denigrating attitude in the mind is the practice of absence of violence in the mind towards ourselves. And of course, the stronger that becomes in us, the stronger and more real it becomes in our approach to life in general. I think it's fair to say that while we may experience the truth that life is precious and we don't really want to cause harm, possibly because circumstances in our lives may have touched us in a way that may be painful or caused us some form of loss or have brought us face to face with our own mortality. And as a result, we've become more open and receptive to life's tender beauty. As time goes by, I think most of us know that the mind gets windy again. It gets busy with other things and we start to forget. And this sense of what life is and how to live it starts to kind of fade into the background to the point where we can even lose touch with our vows. And that's a very serious loss. Of course, the busier the mind is in this digital age, the busier our lives are, the more what I'm saying might actually be the case. Even full-on kensho or a realization or so-called enlightenment experiences can lose their power if they're not cultivated properly at some point. And we might even think that maybe they never happened, or maybe it was just some sort of a dream, or maybe they're just sort of irrelevant. So as I sat there on that little stone wall, letting all of this sink in, Shirley came up to walk with me, and I told her what I was thinking, and she said, you know, Peter, it's true. We do forget. Things do fade into the background. But it isn't just that we forget. We also have things that come up in the moment, maybe things that either we perceive or that we believe are threatening or that actually are quite threatening right then and there, and the adrenaline rush of our fight or flight survival system kicks into gear. We feel it very powerfully in our body, and we may have to, in that moment, make a decision or a choice quickly in real time. And she's right. There are many, many reasons that we can go from experiencing oneness to experiencing what we can call duality, or what might be called otherness, in a flash, faster than we can catch it or think. And sometimes it's just our subjective perception that might or might not be off the mark, but at other times the threat may be actual. I'm sure everyone has experienced this kind of moment at one point or another, and sometimes whether we experience it as a subjective perception with little basis in reality, or if it's the result of an actual threat, what we do can determine whether we or someone else lives or dies. It's not often the case that it's that extreme, but it can be that extreme. And it isn't a matter, really, of whether we're good people or bad people. As I was saying, we're all good people. Or whether we're right or wrong at any given moment, the activity of the mind and how hard it is to maintain full awareness in the midst of life's constantly changing circumstances and the reactions these circumstances induce in our minds and in our bodies are just facts that we live with as human beings. And this is exactly why ongoing practice is so important. It's just like the moment when a doctor, might look across the desk at us and say, as a total surprise, and nobody was really looking for it, I need to tell you that you have a very serious illness. The only and the most important thing that we can ever work with and affect at such a time is our mind. Every moment of the day, moment by moment by moment, no matter what's going on, that's the case. In such moments, there really is nothing we can do to change the diagnosis or to affect some situation that we wish was not happening, like maybe we just found out that our partner ran away with a trumpet player and is living in Kelowna, or, you know, more seriously, maybe that our favorite dog or cat is quite ill. But attending with complete awareness to these beautiful, elegantly complicated minds of ours that are simultaneously conscious and unconscious and forgetful and frightened and loving and compassionate and inaccessible and accessible somewhat and mysterious, being wise enough to know that we must take care of what is right in front of us, which is our minds, and how our mind is going to receive that information. And having a practice that helps us to do just that makes attending to the mind the most important thing that we can do right then and right there. And in Zen, being able to get to our minds, even in a moment of full-on adrenaline rush, is part of what I call ongoing practice, or as Dogen called it in the 13th century, continuous practice, in his life work, Shobo Genzo. And what Dogen said, and this is a quote, what Dogen said was, "Your continuous practice creates the circle of the way. Your practice, my practice, everyone's practice, the continuous ongoing practice that is ours, creates the circle of the way." And that's why this retreat and retreats such as this are so important. They give us a chance to reconnect and to go home through continuously and constantly returning to the only moment in which we actually are, with the fullness of being that we actually are, again and again and again. There's no internet, no phone calls, no shopping channels, no dressing for success, no social relationships, no talking, nothing. Just Dharma relationship. There isn't even letting ourselves be pulled away too long from Zazen by our fantasies or our feelings or our bodily sensations, etc. We come back. We have a way. And just continually coming back to ourselves as fully and presently as we can. Back, back, and back. And in so doing, really digging in and really cultivating that ground of continuous practice with a sincerity and with dedication, with continuous practice. so that we know this ground so well that we can continue to walk it even after the retreat, outside this Zendo, in the larger Zendo of our lives, which we call the world. I'd like to read a little bit, excuse me, from the beginning of Dogen's long two-part fascicle or chapter, Continuous Practice, from his life work that I mentioned, Shobo Genzo, A Treasury of the True Dharma Eye. And I'm going to read from the edition that Kazu Tanahashi and I edited. He was the editor and translator. I was translation and associate editor for this book, and translator. And I want to read it because I really love it. And I think it's so positive. It's so typically Dogen. It's so encouraging and so important for us to understand what Dogen is saying. It's so inspiring, really, and so beautiful. And this is from part one, Continuous Practice. On the great road of Buddha ancestors, there is always unsurpassable practice, continuous and sustained. It forms the circle of the way and is never cut off. Between aspiration, practice, enlightenment, and nirvana, there is not a moment's gap. Continuous practice is the circle of the way. This being so, continuous practice is undivided, not forced by you or others. The power of this continuous practice confirms you as well as others. It means your practice affects the entire earth and the entire sky in the 10 directions, although not noticed by others or even by yourself. It is so. Accordingly, by the continuous practice of all Buddhas and ancestors, your practice is actualized and your great road opens up. By your continuous practice, the continuous practice of all Buddhas is actualized and the great road of all Buddhas opens up. Your continuous practice creates the circle of the way. By this practice, Buddha ancestors abide as Buddha, not abide as Buddha, have Buddha mind, and attain Buddha without it being cut off. Because of this practice, there are the sun, the moon, and the stars. Because of this practice, there are the great earth and the open sky. Because of this practice, there are body, mind, and their environs. Because of this practice, there are the four great elements and the five skandhas. Continuous practice is not necessarily something people in the world love, but it should be the true place of return for everyone. Because of the continuous practice of all Buddhas of the past, present, and future, all Buddhas of the past, present, and future are actualized. The effect of such sustained practice is sometimes not hidden. Therefore, you aspire to practice. The effect is sometimes not apparent. Therefore, you may not see, hear, or know it. Understand that although it is not revealed, it is not hidden. As it is not divided by what is hidden, apparent, existent, or not existent, you may not notice the causal conditions that led you to be engaged in the practice that actualizes you at this very moment of unknowing. The reason you don't see it is that becoming conscious of it is not anything remarkable. Investigate in detail that this is so because the causal condition, the aspiration, is no other than continuous practice, though continuous practice is not limited by the causal condition. Continuous practice that actualizes itself is no other than your continuous practice right now. The now of this practice is not originally possessed by the self. The now of this practice does not come and go, enter and depart. The word now does not exist before continuous practice. The moment when it is actualized is called now. This being so, your continuous practice of this day is a seed of all Buddhas and the practice of all Buddhas. All Buddhas are actualized and sustained by your continuous practice. By not sustaining your continuous practice, you would be excluding Buddhas, not nurturing Buddhas, excluding continuous practice, not being born and dying simultaneously with all Buddhas, and not studying and practicing with all Buddhas. Blossoms opening and leaves falling now are the actualization of continuous practice. Polishing a mirror or breaking a mirror is no other than this practice. Even if you might try to ignore it in order to hide a crooked intention and escape from it, the ignoring would also be continuous practice. To go off here and there looking for continuous practice appears similar to the aspiration for it. But it is like leaving behind the treasure at the home of your true parent and wandering poor in another land. Wandering through wind and water at the risk of your life, you should not discard the treasure of your own parent. While you were searching in this way, the Dharma treasure would be missed. This being so, continuous practice should not slacken even for a moment. Compassionate Father, great teacher Shakyamuni Buddha, was engaged in continuous practice in the deep mountains from the time he was 19 years old. At age 30, after practicing continuously, he attained the way simultaneously with all sentient beings on the great earth. Until he was 80 years old, practice was sustained in mountains, forests, and monasteries. He did not return to the palace, nor did he claim any property. He wore the same robes and held the same bowls throughout his lifetime. From the time he began teaching, he was not alone, even for a day or even for an hour. He did not reject offerings from humans and devas. He was patient with the criticism of people outside the way. Wearing the pure robes and begging for food, the Buddha's entire lifetime of teaching was nothing but continuous practice. So those are quotes from Dogen. And after this part, Dogen gives many examples of Zen and Buddha ancestors in continuous practice. Excuse me. The way they lived and the amazing things that they did are really quite extraordinary examples of dedication, of putting their aspiration to live the awakened life at the forefront of their lives. But always, it just involved not losing sight of the most important thing, which was the continuous practice, the ongoing continuous practice of their way. About a year ago, about a year ago, I was teaching in Toronto, and I met in Dokusan with all of the students at the retreat. And one of them was a very sincere student, a very good practitioner, who asked me how he could not lose the way. There were many ways I could have answered that. But he said, "How can I not lose the way?" And I said, "Well, just take care of the most important thing." And so he asked, "What is the most important thing?" And I answered him. I replied, "Right. What is the most important thing?" And later on in the retreat, he came to see me again, and he said that as he left our meeting, as he left our Dokusan, with his question as my answer, he was really mad at me because he felt that I didn't answer his question, though my reply was my answer. But the question... the question remained and echoed in his mind as he went back to the Zendo. And then he said as he was walking back in at the back of the Zendo, he saw that a chair was kind of sticking out where somebody might trip on it. So he adjusted the chair back into place. And then a few steps later, he noticed that someone had accidentally left the chant book on the floor where it might get stepped on and or be damaged. So he picked up the chant book and he put the chant book where it belonged. And then he told me a few more things like that happened, almost as if it was a setup. And each one of them caught his attention and required a certain amount of care, which he gave. And so then he broke into a big smile and he said, I realized I was discovering what was the most important thing. It was really a gorgeous moment. I didn't ask him to put a name on it, to say what was the most important thing, but I was really happy to see that he had entered the flow. He had somehow, because he held that question in his mind, he had discovered one form of continuous practice. And this person's realization exemplifies Dogen saying, to practice one thing thoroughly is the vast continuous practice of the Buddha's timeless life. This continuous practice is bound to be sustained by continuous practice. Isn't that great? This continuous practice is bound to be sustained by continuous practice. So we sustain continuous practice by continuous practice. We cultivate continuous practice by a continuous practice. We cultivate our realizations, whatever they are. We could say large or small, it's unimportant. But we cultivate our realizations through the continuous practice of those realizations. So Dogen said, this continuous practice is bound to be sustained by continuous practice. Love and respect your body, mind, and self that are engaged in this continuous practice. And Dogen often included our environment, our environs, when speaking of the self. He didn't separate the self from the environment in which we live. So I might amend Dogen's statement with his permission. And say, love and respect your body, mind, self, and environs that are engaged in this continuous practice. After all, as you know, we don't practice alone. Dogen refers to the continuous practice of the earth and the sky and the heavens and the stars. Continuous practice is everywhere. Everything fully engaged that is truly as it truly is the continuous practice of our way. For human beings, Dogen said, a day of fully engaged activity is the continuous practice of all Buddhas. So possibly we might have some kind of idea of what fully engaged activity might appear to be for a tree or a river or for clouds. But what is fully engaged activity for those of us who are human beings? To help us understand at least one element of what Dogen means by a continuous practice for human beings, or what he might mean by continuous practice for human beings, I'd like to end my talk with this one statement of Dogen's. And then I'll ask Judith to help organize the next part of this study session. And Dogen said, continuous practice, day after day, is the most appropriate way of expressing gratitude. And so I thank you for your sincere practice. I encourage you to not let yourself get pulled away, but continue to come back. Take that backward step, the step back inside, so that the radiant shining of your nature can continuously shine as you go from one thing to the next, and you realize that there actually isn't one thing and the next. There is just really a continuous practice. And so thank you for your sincere practice, and I hope you enjoy it all the way through the day and beyond. And I'll bring my talk to an end now, and Judith, if you would please introduce the exercise for our study. And thank you so much.